Hey, it's Melissa from Melissa in the Morning on WICC 600, and thanks for checking out the podcast right here. If you want, you can always subscribe, share, and like it. Hope to see you guys soon. Thanks.
What's happening across Connecticut? Melissa in the Morning's conversation with Governor Ned Lamont. Now on WICC 600.
Governor Lamont, good morning. How was your Thanksgiving?
Good morning, Melissa. I had my family with me, and it was a pretty nice break.
That's wonderful. That's nice. Has the tree gone up at your place yet?
The tree has come up. I'm going to take some kids through the residence. I'm afraid we're not going to have our traditional, you know, holiday party just like last year. It's probably just a little too early to do that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, you did a really cool virtual walkthrough. You and your wife did a really neat virtual, I thought, and you really showed me your historian side of you, Governor Lamont. I was very impressed. Are you doing another one of those this year?
Well, maybe we'll do it with the kids. That's a good idea.
Well, there you go.
As we walk them through, tell a little bit about the history of this place and what the holidays mean.
Yeah, I think that'd be very cool. All right, I'll keep an eye out for it. Thank you. Well, you kind of hinted to it, Governor Lamont, that unfortunately we're really not back to where we are. This week in particular has been very daunting. I've noticed our positivity rate has been anywhere between 5% and 6.5%, which is the highest it has been in 10 months. Let's start there. What are sort of your thoughts on that?
My thoughts are, hey, I got to admit, it's pretty frustrating. We're the most vaccinated state in the country. People are beginning to really get the boosters now. I thought that would certainly slow the effects of what is now the flu season. I hope it is. But, you know, we're over 6% again today, 5.7% infection, you know, for the last week. That's almost double where we were a few weeks ago.
Mm-hmm.
So, my sense is if you haven't gotten the booster, get the booster and be cautious this holiday season.
What do you think is causing the uptick, Governor Lamont? And I know, you know, look, I'm a huge believer in the vaccine, but I have to be honest, just between you and me, and I've obviously told our listeners, though, we went to my in-laws last week and everyone was vaccinated. As far as we knew, everyone was vaccinated. And yet my husband's aunt and uncle who hosted the dinner both tested positive for COVID. Their daughter tested positive. Luckily, we did not. But again, a very small gathering. Everyone was supposed to be vaccinated, and yet this happened. Do you think it really has to do with the fact that people are not getting their boosters, or what do you think is causing the sudden uptick?
Well, certainly we saw a few weeks ago that New Hampshire, Vermont, even Rhode Island, all around us was getting redder and redder, and we know that we're not an island. My instinct is, Melissa, and it's only an instinct at this point, the booster loses its effectiveness after 6, 7, 8 months, and we got to really reinforce, especially for everybody now, 18 and above, everybody, get your booster now. The vaccine loses its effectiveness, starts losing it after 6 months.
Mm-hmm. And I would think, too, Governor Lamont, that we probably, and I know I was reading this earlier this week, you were debating doing something with vaccination statuses for businesses and restaurants, because I think we have become a little lax when it comes to masking up, even going into grocery stores or into closed spaces, especially in the colder months. What were you debating doing?
We're looking at a software platform that can go right onto your phone so you don't necessarily have to carry a proof of vaccination. It's just an easy identification. A lot of businesses, a lot of restaurants, a lot of stores have said, look, we want to be a little more proactive about this. Can you make it easier for us? So we said, let us look into it. You know, it's still going to be on a voluntary basis. It's getting held up a little bit because I'm trying to do this with Massachusetts and our neighboring states. We can do this on a system-wide basis.
It sounds like the Excelsior plan that they do in New York. Is that what you're talking about?
It's similar to that. Exactly right.
Okay. So are they in on it as well, or you're trying to work with more of the northern states?
We're talking to New York as well. Anytime you can standardize it, speak with one voice, it does make it easier.
Mm-hmm. No, definitely. Talking to Governor Lamont this morning, and of course, COVID is at the top of mind for a lot of people, especially since this newest variant has popped up right after Thanksgiving, actually. And Governor Lamont, we learned this morning that it is officially in New York. My understanding is there's a couple of cases that popped up in New York City, one in Long Island. So literally right here in our own backyard. I mean, that is a hop, skip, and a jump away from Greenwich. Do you fear that the new variant is already here in Connecticut?
I think so.
Yeah.
I think so.
Mm-hmm.
The bad news is it's highly infectious, but all indications are that the vaccines work. Whether they're 100% or 85%, time will tell, but they make a big difference.
Yeah, no question. So I guess with the question of this new variant, are you planning? I mean, I'm sure you've gotten asked this question 700 times. You planning any mandates? Are you planning any mask mandates? Like anything that you're sort of talking to your administration, your health department with at this point?
You know, I'm really not. I'll tell you why. We've got to keep people getting to work. You know, if I was thinking about requiring boosters, then maybe think about nurses at nursing homes where they're only 20-25% have gotten the booster. And you know how risky nursing homes are. But at the same time, Melissa, we're having a hard time keeping wings of nursing home open for lack of nurses, lack of personnel. So you've got to get a good balance there. I'd like to think that with this variant, people are going to just automatically use their common sense, be a lot more vigilant, much more likely to wear a mask if they're in a public place, and much more likely to get the booster.
And I noticed, Governor Lamont, that there were not a lot, but there were a good amount of nursing homes that did not comply, at least just yet, with your mandate rules. And altogether, it was a pretty hefty fine because they were getting fined per day. You know, for people who are worried about that, you know, I know that the mandates are very controversial. I know there's no winning here. OK, there's going to be people who like it and there's going to be people who don't. But for those who have loved ones in the nursing homes, you know, what can you tell them this morning when you see headlines like some nursing homes are not in compliance? What should people know listening this morning who have loved ones there?
People should know that we're holding the nursing homes accountable. People should know that we're bringing the booster vaccines right to every single nursing home. People should know that well over 85% or over 85% of the residents of the nursing homes have gotten their booster. That should give you a little bit of confidence. And when you go visit grandma, wear a mask.
Governor Lamont, I had a question because I know earlier this week you talked about paid family leave. Now, we've had Connecticut paid leave come on our show several times in the very beginning with the process of how should businesses sign up for this? Why are they signing up for it? Qualifying events, so on and so forth. Point blank, how much money per week if people did apply? Let's just say they are having a baby, they adopted, they have a sick family member, whatever the case may be. How much can they potentially make a week?
You can get up to 90%+ if you're about minimum wage, and you can get less than that, up to I think it's $780 a week maximum if you're at a higher wage. But you're not going to make as much as you were, but you're going to be more than compensated. But the good news is that we got this set up. Andrea Barton Reeves got this set up on budget, ahead of budget and ahead of schedule.
Mm-hmm.
So people can now register online if they see a surgery coming up or if they know that they're going to be birthing at a certain point, give them some comfort and confidence that the program is there to support them.
Okay. And we're confident that this program is going to be able to last. I mean, in the last year, we've been able to build it up enough that there's a lot of money in that account. But we're going to be able to maintain that to continue forward infinitely, right?
Yeah, that's right, Melissa. I mean,
okay.
Usually state government just sort of borrows and pay as you go. Here we've set up a trust fund, if you will. There'll be about $400 million in it by the end of January. I think right now all of our actuarial assumptions are holding true.
Excellent. Well, Governor Lamont, we actually have a question coming in from Josh in Trumbull, and this is in regards to Metro North. Good morning, Josh. What's your question for Governor Lamont?
You've had more definite discussions with Metro North about adding more service into Manhattan and coming home, and if not necessarily, increasing the amount of train runs they're doing, adding more cars, or putting back express stops. These trains are getting more and more crowded. I've been typically going into the city 2 days a week for about the last 5 months. People are standing in the aisles at this point, and yesterday the train came into Fairfield at 9:33 in the morning. People already standing in the aisles. The conductor was apologizing for the train being 2 to 3 cars short. I don't understand how you can have short trains when so many trains are idled in the yards right now. And a woman even passed out on the train between Stamford and Manhattan because she was standing.
So Josh in Trumbull asking about Metro North, Governor Lamont, what can you tell him about that?
I can tell you we're adding on cars every month. As you maybe remember, a year ago we were down at maybe 10 to 15% of ridership. So the only good news is that people are getting back into the trains. I didn't know that many people were all going into the office at the same time. But I will talk to Joe Giletti right now, and we'll get back to you, Melissa, in terms of what our plans are to add on additional cars and add on additional express trains. I know we're monitoring this very carefully, adding on every month or two.
Well, we appreciate that. Thank you,
Josh.
Governor Lamont. Yeah, and thank you, Josh, for your question. Getting another question in this morning, Governor Lamont from Curtis, asking about motor vehicles being closed on Mondays. Is there a way to open it up, I guess, full week? I wasn't even aware of that.
I wasn't. This is a DMV. It's closed on Mondays.
Apparently, I don't know. When Curtis called in and spoke to our producer, he just said motor vehicles closed on Mondays. I don't know which one or if that's across the state. Did he say, Christian? Across the state. Okay, so yeah, across the state.
Well,
he's wondering.
Let me check on that. But the good news is you can renew your license and do 80% of what you had to go to motor vehicle for. You can do that all online. And you can do that, I think it's 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. So hopefully Curtis doesn't have to wait till Tuesday. If he wants to get it done, he can get it done now while in his pajamas having a cup of coffee at home.
Which sounds delightful. We're talking to Governor Lamont, taking your questions this morning. A lot of great questions coming in, and we so appreciate it. Governor Lamont, you know, I noticed we've been covering it very closely. We have talked to Mayor Nancy Rossi about it here in West Haven. I know this probably prompted the reason for doing this. The COVID money and how everything was handled in West Haven has now basically led to every municipality being looked at closely about their COVID money. Like, who's overlooking this? Do we have a firm coming into Connecticut? Who is it? What are we doing about the COVID situation per municipalities?
Yeah, West Haven was so disappointing. This is about public trust. They violated that trust. So what Melissa McCaw over at Office of Policy and Management is doing, that money goes directly to the municipalities. We don't necessarily monitor that. But what she has done is called in independent auditors to check on each and every one of our municipalities just to give people confidence this money is being appropriately invested. You know, at the state level, OPM, as you know, we have the our state auditors, one Republican, one Democrat. They have a staff of about 100, I'm told, and they are going over our numbers very carefully as well. They'll be doing that over the next few years since the infrastructure money and the ARPA relief money is still coming in. So we'll be tracking this very closely.
So are we, I just want to make sure I understand it, Governor Lamont, are we having sort of like an overarching entity look at everybody, or are we going to assign someone per municipality to make sure this doesn't happen elsewhere?
My understanding, Melissa, is it'll be an independent auditing firm that, you know, we hire the state to keep an eye on what's going on at the municipal level. And as you know, we have the Office of the Auditors. It's a state function appointed by the legislature. They have a, 100 independent auditors under their jurisdiction. They're keeping an eye on the state allocation of monies.
Well, Governor Lamont, I wish I had hours to talk to you. I so appreciate you giving us the time, taking our listener questions. And of course, we'll chat again in a couple of weeks. Thank you so much. I'll look out for that Christmas tree video.
There you go, Melissa. Hey, thanks. Great talking to everybody.
Thank you so much. That's Governor Ned Lamont here on WICC. And we are excited to have back on the show this morning Patrick Commons, who is the executive director of the Connecticut Audubon Society. Good morning, Patrick. Thanks for being here.
Oh, you're welcome, and thanks for having me on.
So, Patrick,
good morning.
Good morning. Yesterday, you guys had a Zoom meeting, and you revealed a recent report on bird populations. What was revealed in that report?
Lots of things were revealed in the report. We've been doing this for 16 years now. This is our 16th edition of the State of Connecticut, State of the Birds. And it seems like every year it gets better and better. I mean, over the last 5 years, all of our editions have been amazing. But I think this one is particularly important because it talks about the role that Connecticut plays in the global picture and shows how there are species that are declining at significant rates for which Connecticut provides, declining globally, for which Connecticut provides absolutely critical habitat. So in a sense, it underscores the fact that conservation isn't something we have to think about at the Great Barrier Reef or the Pampas of Argentina or, the Amazon rainforest. We play a critical role right here on the shores of Long Island Sound and throughout Connecticut.
I love that you said that, Patrick. And the reason I say that is because I remember going to Australia and seeing the Great Barrier Reef. And it seems like every person, if you were to talk to anyone in Australia, anyone, and we went to different places, we went to Sydney, so we went all over the place. Every person you talk to in Australia knows what a gem the Great Barrier Reef is, for example. And yet, if you come to Connecticut, I don't know if people realize what a gem we have in our bird population and what we do for them. Do you mind kind of giving us a snapshot, like an example even, what birds rely on Connecticut?
How many days do you have? But no.
Well, we certainly could talk a little.
there are more than 400 species of birds in Connecticut, and that is kind of overwhelming, and that's one of the reasons for this report is we wanted to start sort of dialing it down to what are the most important species in Connecticut. And it gets to be kind of complex calculus because birds can be important for Connecticut and Connecticut can be important for birds. And I think both things are important to take into account. And what I mean by that is we'll take upland sandpiper, for example. That's a highly endangered species in Connecticut and regionally in the Northeast. They require large areas of open habitat, mostly big grasslands, 400 acres plus. In fact, they're losing one of their biggest nesting sites in New England soon with the development of Rentschler Field. Upland sandpipers are actually one of the few species of shorebirds that's increasing in North America. So we're kind of at the edge of their range. One might say, let's kind of triage them off. And maybe there's some wisdom to that. But to me, I think it's important for us to preserve the biodiversity of our state. Even though we're not important to upland sandpipers, I feel upland sandpipers and grasshopper sparrows and leaf bitterns and these really highly endangered birds that we're on the edge of the range for, they contribute to the biodiversity of Connecticut, as do Hessel's hair streaks and northern meadow larks and spotted turtles. So there's one, that's a way of looking how endangered is it in Connecticut. And then the other way to look at things is how important is Connecticut for this species? And this report focuses a little bit more on that. It's focusing on species that are declining globally or, over a significant portion of the range. The one species in there, ironically, that is not declining globally is the roseate tern. But the North Atlantic populations of roseate tern are actually endangered and really endangered. They could easily go extinct within the next couple of decades. So there are all of these different ways of looking at conservation. Mm-hmm. Roseate terns, we have one of the largest nesting colonies in the world right off our shores. We're going to annex Great Gull Island and make it part of Connecticut. But that's more than 1,000 pairs of these nesting federally endangered roseate terns. And that's one of the species we cover in our report. But it's not just the exotic and the mundane. Some of our most common birds are declining. These studies, Peter Mara from Georgetown University, he was a lead author in the original study that indicated that there are 3 billion fewer birds today than there were in 1970.
Wow.
And this was done through a a really replicable analysis. They took a look at Christmas bird count data, at summer bird count data. Well, not summer bird count, but breeding bird atlas, breeding bird survey data, breeding bird census, and radar studies, eBird numbers. And the conclusion was, without much statistical doubt, that our bird populations have declined by approximately 30% overall in North America in terms of biomass. And of course, that's been, not really in biomass actually, but in terms of the absolute numbers of the birds. And you know, this is concerning. You know, some of our still most common species, like wood thrush, have declined at 70% or 80%, and including in Connecticut. And wood thrush is another species, is a species that has a complex biology. It needs nesting areas, it needs migratory stopover habitat, and it needs wintering areas. Mm-hmm. And Connecticut provides important function for two of those things. We're primarily a wooded state, and wood thrush are actually one of the most common and widespread nesting birds in Connecticut. They're much less common than they used to be. One of the reasons is our forests have become a little too mature for them, and not they require some really nice thick understory to nest. Mm-hmm. But we play a key role here for their nesting because they're so common here, and we do have some good habitat places like Meshamasick, or even Keeney Park in Hartford. These birds, though, then leave our area, and birds from the north come through our area, and they need places to stop over, places like Smith Richardson and Larson Sanctuary, mm-hmm. and Bent of the River and Southbury. And then they need, healthy areas in northern Central America and southern Mexico.
Continuing the conversation with Patrick Commons this morning. Patrick, I know you've mentioned a lot of development being one of the biggest reasons why bird populations are down. And I'm curious, you know, what are your thoughts on the Remington Woods situation? There have been a lot of our listeners who have spoken out trying to save that and preserve that land between Bridgeport and Stratford. Even our own Senator Blumenthal has said that he wanted to make it a national preserve. And it sounds like this week the Planning and Zoning Commission has given the allowance to the private owner to now make it an office park and save some open space. Are these the kind of projects you're talking about where it's detrimental to our bird populations?
Well, yes and no. I mean, Remington Woods is an amazing place, and I would, we would love to see it preserved as much as anybody else. We actually tried to submit comments, but there was a glitch in one of the hearings, and we joined by Zoom, and there was just like no meeting, and we couldn't submit our comments. But then it got crazy, and we weren't able to submit comments personally, but we were certainly supportive of the effort. The thing about Remington Woods is it's a complicated project. It's private property. It's owned by a corporation. I think it's Corteva that owns it, mm-hmm. these days, but which obviously it was former Remington, former DuPont, former Dow, big company. And Connecticut is a very strong private property rights state. So it would have been very difficult for the Planning and Zoning Commission to reject this proposal. Just because there's a Planning and Zoning Commission loss on something doesn't necessarily mean it's a fait accompli that's going to be developed. Frankly, some preservation may be the best we can hope for. It's all a matter of finances. And a lot of times we have to be very practical in our conservation efforts. It would be wonderful if we could get some federal monies, and it's not entirely out of the picture. There's a lot of money coming in for Long Island conservation of Long Island Sound. We've been, Connecticut Audubon Society has been very in the forefront of helping to secure more money for Long Island Sound and for Connecticut, the Connecticut River, to improve habitat for places and to protect habitat. So, what this zoning decision, at least from my understanding of real estate, and I was involved in real estate prior to coming into conservation, really, it increases the price of the land because now they have a subdividable, developable property, and it would be very difficult for a planning and zoning commission to come in and say, no, you can't develop your property unless it doesn't fit into their planning and zoning local planning and zoning regulations. In a sense, that's an uncompensated take of private property. Connecticut is New England. You think of property rights, you think of places like Texas and out west, but really New England is as rabid. If it's your property, you don't want people telling you what you can do
right
with it. But that being said, private property is also so critical here in Connecticut. So, if there's a possibility of making it a national park, a national wildlife refuge, getting some land and water conservation fund money in there. I mean, there's a lot of focus on environmental justice. Does the community as a whole, what does the community want? I know that there's a big movement in the conservation groups that we should keep it entirely undeveloped as a park. And there's certainly some wisdom for that, from an ecological perspective and also from a quality of life perspective. But mm-hmm. What is the overall sentiment in the community? Are there folks that would rather see the tax base and the jobs in there? And sometimes you have to compromise in order to get what you want.
Mm-hmm.
Basically, our policy on Remington Woods is that we would like to see as much of it as possible preserved.
Yeah. Patrick, yeah. Really quick, Patrick, because I know we're running out of time. Last time I had the Audubon on, we talked about that we shouldn't have things like bird feeders up because that also surprisingly does impact the bird populations. Are you still recommending that to folks to keep bird feeders down?
No. It seems that crisis has passed. It could always rear its head again next year. We're going to be watchful. But so far, there haven't been many birds coming to feeders, and that's in part because of weather and migration patterns. A lot of birds are still way up north. They're chickadees and goldfinches galore up in New Hampshire, but almost none around here except in a few spotty places. So feeding is great, and this is the perfect time of year to do it. Once the snow starts flying, the bears tend to den up and people in bear country can start putting up their feeders again, too. So, winter is a great time for feeding. So far, there's not many exciting winter visitors, but, all the birds are exciting. And if you get a visit from a pine siskin or a purple finch, that's always, inspiring.
Okay. But there's no concern over the birds getting sick like we were seeing months ago.
Well, yeah, I wouldn't say there's no concern, but
less
of a concern. And, we're keeping an eye on the situation, and it's safe to go back to feeders, but people should just keep an eye on it, keep their feeders clean, and, notice if there's any problems.
Patrick, I would love to have you back on the show really soon. I could talk to you for an hour and honestly take listener questions at some point. I would love to have you on again really soon. Yes?
Yeah.
Okay. Great.
I there's so much to talk about. It's an exciting winter in some ways. There's a lot of exciting things going on for conservation. And I'd love to talk more about this report because, as I said, there are about 420 species of birds that occur in Connecticut, mm-hmm. and plus other wildlife. We're focused on other wildlife as well.
Right. Well, let's do it then, Patrick. When we get off the air, I will we'll schedule another time to have you back on really soon, and we'll dive more into the report. That would be great.
Awesome.
Thank you so much, Patrick Commons, Executive Director of the Connecticut Audubon Society. Thank you so much for coming on. We really appreciate it.
What's happening in Washington and how it affects you? Melissa in the Morning. Welcome Congressman Jim Himes to WICC 600.
Good morning, Congressman Himes. Hope you had a nice Thanksgiving with your family.
Good morning, Melissa. Yes, I did. Thank you very much.
Good. I'm glad to hear that. Well, Congressman Himes, crisis averted literally in the nick of time. No government shutdown. What do you think?
Yeah, well, I'm delighted. It feels funny to in any way celebrate actually not shutting down the government. But sadly, if you look at the history of the last couple of years, that has happened because mm-hmm. there's always some senator or whatever who wants to repeal Obamacare. Or in this instance, there was a threat to this just blows my mind. It absolutely blows my mind. But the threat was to shut down the government, to use that as leverage to rescind vaccine mandates. Now, I know mandates are a little controversial, but I just can you imagine? I mean, the government, remember, the government government includes like the Centers for Disease Control and an awful lot of the entities that are
Social Security.
24/7.
Right. Right. No, I saw that. I saw it was on vaccine mandates. And I mean, I had hope. I had hope that it was going to be, you know, not happen. And luckily it's not.
Yep,
so that's,
and it didn't happen. And so fortunately, I'm not forced to explain that today. But no, crisis averted. Now we've got, you know, a couple more weeks before the Congress closes for the Christmas break, the holiday break. But a few things to do like the debt ceiling, but we can talk about that when that comes up, hopefully in the next week or two.
Yeah, no, that would be great. I also know, Congressman Himes, we're in the midst of open enrollment. I know healthcare tends to be at the top of a lot of people's minds right now. And you and I think have talked about, I know Governor Lamont and I have talked about it in length. We've talked about drug prices and how astronomical they are, how sometimes it seems like it's a little shady, how the prices are just so astronomical. And in fact, we do have a call in from one of our listeners. Maureen is actually weighing in on that conversation this morning and has a question for you. Good morning, Maureen. What's your question for Congressman Himes?
Good morning, Congressman. And thank you, Melissa, for taking my call. Congressman, my daughter is a 35-year-old insulin-dependent diabetic who's, because of her husband's company's changing insurance, is going from currently she pays $50 a year for her insulin. Next year, with the change of insurance companies, it's going to go to $720 a year. And with regard to her diabetic supplies, she was only paying $150 a quarter, not subject to a deductible. And now she's going to be paying $2,800 for supplies, $975 for supplies, subject to a $4,700 deductible and a $25 coinsurance. So what's going from being affordable for her and her husband is totally unaffordable. What are they to do?
Yeah, thanks for the question, Maureen. I wish terrible situation, and I wish it were an uncommon situation, but it's not. I never have a town hall meeting or a conversation with a group of constituents where there isn't a story like that. And it's absolutely infuriating. You know, the drug companies make money by cranking up prices on Americans. We've got the highest drug prices in the world. The insurance companies, of course, they make money by charging you more for higher deductibles. So what form of relief might be out there? I can't, without knowing the real details of your daughter's case, I can say a couple of things. Number one, it's always worth talking to the manufacturer of the pharmaceutical. It's bewilderingly complicated, but drug manufacturers almost always have programs to give breaks to people for whom their drug is unaffordable. So I can't tell you that there's going to be a solution there, but there often is, and I would just encourage your daughter to reach out to whoever the manufacturers are of her insulin. The other thing I'll say, and I wanted to say this second because it's not a done deal yet. You've probably heard a lot about the Build Back Better plan, which passed the House 2 weeks from now and has not yet passed the Senate. So that's why I'm talking about that second. The Build Back Better plan, which controversial, depending on which channel you turn on TV, you're going to hear good things or bad things about it. But it does contain a provision which would allow for the negotiation, the direct negotiation by the government around very commonly used drugs, and would include limits on the price of insulin. It has a bunch of other things that I think are important, including things like out-of-pocket caps for our seniors that are on Medicare. That's not your daughter's situation, obviously, but I would, and again, I don't want to tell you that everything's going to be fine because it has not yet passed the Senate, but I'd take a quick look at the provisions that are in the Build Back Better plan for controlling, for the first time ever, really making an effort to control the price of our pharmaceuticals.
Mm-hmm. We've been dealing with it. She's been a type 1 diabetic since 18 years old. I mean, this nearly bankrupted me. Every time the insurance company changes, United Healthcare is reasonable and affordable with regard to this. Obviously, they have a good contract with these drug companies, and Cigna does not. Cigna is the one, and we've done this year after year, is the one that jacks up these prices and cause, you know, these things shouldn't be subject to a deductible. They should be under prescription drug plan, and it's not. It's durable medical equipment. They have to pay 25% coinsurance. They have to pay the deductible. They've done this before. Cigna robs people of their future by doing this. They did this to me when I was her, when she was my dependent, and now the same thing is happening again. I don't understand how one insurance company can be so reasonably priced, and then the other one is obviously price gouging.
I'm so sorry to hear that, and it's not uncommon. And you know, this is the result of decisions that are made inside these insurance companies. You know, it's part of our larger healthcare debate. You know, this is not a problem in places like Canada, places like Europe, where the government takes more of a role, and it's not some private company, Cigna or United Healthcare or whoever, making decisions that affect, you know, and often affect in a medically dangerous way. People like your daughter, because what happens in those cases, sometimes people stop buying the drugs they need to be healthy. And
right.
It's a horrifying thing. And I said, hopefully there'll be a solution here. By the way, for the benefit of your listeners, just Maureen didn't mention this, but type 1 diabetes, often diagnosed in a child, and it can be potentially fatal, and it's managed by closely monitoring the glucose levels in the child's bloodstream. Imagine, you've got a 9-year-old or a 13-year-old child who could be left blind or even die if those levels are not adequately monitored. And you're dealing with a child here who, you know, let's face it, children are obviously not, mature enough in many instances to monitor those levels. So on top of the economic hardship that Maureen is talking about in the case of type 1 diabetes, there's also the abject fear of a lot of parents about whether, you know, whether their child is going to be capable of monitoring those glucose levels.
Mm-hmm. And Maureen, we do thank you for your call. And, you know, and you do touch on something that a lot of people have been doing, Congressman Himes, is that, you know, whether it's your medications or it's even just your health insurance, people are just kind of taking the risk and saying, hey, I'm not even going to pay for it because it has become so incredibly expensive. And I know state to state it's totally different, but that's something, as I mentioned, we've been monitoring and talking about. But in Maureen, and I'm sure many other people's cases, until Build Back Better, until we know where that is at, what is your recommendation for people if they are finding they're in the same situation?
Well, Melissa, it's hard to know. I'm not an expert in choosing insurance plans and that sort of thing. But, I can think of a couple of things depending. I can't say if this is right for Maureen because I just don't know enough about the case. But as I said before, oftentimes if there's financial stress on somebody who has a drug that they have to take, they can go to the manufacturer of that drug and say, hey, this is a huge economic burden. And all of these drug companies do have programs that are designed to make sure that nobody gets totally priced out of their market. That doesn't always work, but it's always worth asking that question.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing that might be done, if we're talking about economic distress here, some of our communities, public health departments, some of our health centers, our health clinics, have programs that are allowed, that are designed to make drugs more affordable. So it's always worth putting in a phone call to one of the health clinics. In our area, it's Southwest, CHC, and Optimus that are our health clinics, our federally qualified health centers. It's always worth putting a call there because, by and large, the population that those clinics are dealing with are people who are under a lot of economic stress. So that's also a phone call worth making. And then, of course, this is bewilderingly complicated. I did it myself 2 weeks ago. And again, it's what Maureen is saying. You know, how can Cigna offer something so radically different than United Healthcare? It's always worth taking the trouble to do those comparisons in the open enrollment period, you know, because they are so, I mean, frankly, the temptation, it certainly it was my temptation to say, oh, my God, this is so complicated. I'm just going to stick with what I have. But usually, particularly with the existence of the exchanges, there are a number of options. And it's always worth doing the math, even though it's complicated, on all of those different insurance options, because in some instances, you can save a lot of money if you choose a different plan.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. It's definitely worth talking to an agent or a broker about that. Congressman Himes, unfortunately, we have run out of time, but I thank you for talking about this topic in length, and we'll chat again next week.
Thanks a lot, Melissa. Take care.
We appreciate it.